Vaginas are absolute magic, and Ollie is here to give them the respect they deserve. That means shame-free supplements made with clinically studied ingredients to keep your pH in check and your pleasure a priority. Put yourself on top. Go to Ollie.com today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Brooks Running has a new shoe for you runners out there. Did you hear that? Better turn up your volume. In fact, turn it up to the max. Introducing the all-new Ghost Max. It's got all kinds of things to make your knees and ankles feel protected, like Max Cushion, Max Soft Landings with DNA Loft V2 Foam, and Max Smooth Rides with their Glide Roll Rocker. Feel better on your run with Ghost Max. Learn more at brooksrunning.com.
Hey, hey, you guys. You are listening to the Oh Crap Potty Training Podcast. I am your host, Jamie Kowacki, and I am the author of Oh Crap Potty Training and Oh Crap, I Have a Toddler. And today I am here interviewing Erica Desper. She is the founder of Confident Parenting, and she is a certified Oh Crap Potty Training consultant, as well as being an expert in sleep. And I have Erica on today because there's quite a few Oh Crap consultants who help parents potty train. And Erica had posted in our private group, hey, do you guys check in on bedtimes and nap times when you do potty training consultants? And I was like, yeah. But then it occurred to me that I hadn't really had a sleep expert on this podcast. I talk about sleep endlessly on my other podcast, but potty training and sleep go hand in hand together. So welcome, Erica. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I wouldn't rather spend my day any other way than with the poop lady.
Yeah. Poop and sleep, my two favorite things. Tell us a bit about yourself and your family and your business.
Yeah, sure. So first and foremost, I'm a mom. My son just turned 13 years old, actually. And he is what we commonly call a high need kiddo. So we had a rough parenting journey. I didn't love the newborn phase. He was very fussy. Breastfeeding was a challenge. He didn't sleep for the first year. We did eventually solve it. And very cliche story, I was like, man, I wish somebody could have helped me figure that out, why it was happening, why sleep wasn't working, what my options were to change it, because I was very crunchy at the time. And I was adamantly opposed to him crying at all, especially to crying alone. So I felt a little trapped between what I couldn't sustain, but what I couldn't felt like I could do, you know, to get away from it. So I just wanted to help other families know that there are options and there's support. And so 11 years ago, or almost 12 now, I started offering sleep support. And then of course, the next logical step, what families tackle once they are well-rested is potty training. So you and I met and I added that in as well. And it's really been awesome for families.
Yeah. So what have you found? I know my opinion, but what have you found the tight link between sleep and potty training particularly?
Yeah, I mean, it is the first thing I like to find out. I mean, it's hard to ever put my sleep hat aside. I always want to know how everyone's sleeping, whatever the challenge is.
And I want to know how everybody's pooping. I'm like the most awkward person at a mom event because I'm like, did everybody poop today?
Your child has behavioral problems. What's their poop look like? Maybe they're uncomfortable. Yeah, I mean, we live in a culture that really is a little underinformed about sleep in terms of like how much maybe your child should be getting, and then just the value and then the repercussions when the quality or the quantity or especially both are not in the right place. So I think parents just aren't aware sometimes. It's obviously not happening on purpose. And kids, you know, they like to give us a hard time and make sleep hard to come by. So it's not an easy challenge. But the biggest connection I find and the easiest analogy I share with parents is the hangry analogy. We all know what it feels like to be hangry. Some of us maybe more than others. I'm pointing, but this is a podcast. You can't see me pointing to myself. And we know what our kids are like when they're hangry. They're just not themselves. And the biggest way they're not themselves is that they can't really cope with anything, especially things they don't like. So since a lot of kids aren't super excited to get through the potty training process, there are those kids that are, but a lot of the ones we work with are not so much. They'd like to just keep doing it the way that they have been. So when we're asking them to cope with this big change or even just with a learning process that they are excited about, if their coping skills are being diminished by a low quality of sleep, a low quantity of sleep, I would say that sometimes it makes the process impossible. Other times it just makes it longer and more challenging for everybody than it really needed to be.
Yeah. Up until potty training, all learning has been like, whatever. You know, like they learn to walk and you're like, yeah, they're going to fall, that whatever. It's not like you learn to walk and you have to walk to the kitchen now. Like that's not how it goes, right? And so potty training is the first learning curve that there's only like kind of one way and there's only one desirable outcome. And so it's a really intense learning curve. And that if they're not set up for their best selves, like they have to be their best selves. I say this, I think maybe in Oh Crap, I Have a Toddler, but my mom one time we were at a playground and she was watching kids all over the place. And she was like, damn, you parents today don't give your kids half a chance to be their best self. And I was like, what? And she was like, they got to be fed and slept. Like it's basic.
Go back to the basics.
Yeah. That's how I view. Like you can't, can you learn your best if you are underslept? Like I'm a freaking disaster if I even miss an hour of sleep.
Yes, I'm pretty much a basket case. Well, and the other big correlation I see is that parents often underestimate how much the burden of the process is going to be on them or feel like it's on them at first. So like we try to help, and I know you try to help parents do a lot of mental preparation. Let's clear my schedule. Let's get some things situated. Let's get help with the younger kiddos. If your child isn't sleeping, you probably aren't getting the right quantity and quality either because you're responding to them, which means that you too are heading into the process or trying to navigate the process from a place of also being the sleep version of hangry. And then we know that there's, or we can tell parents that there are mirror neurons. You know, if you are giving off a vibe of, you know, stressed and on high alert and something's wrong, or this is urgent, we've got to figure it out really quickly. That's kind of what you're going to get back from your kiddo. So you can't really show up as your best self either, which is what they need. So you can be the labor coach, like you talk about in your book, like you're fine. We'll figure this out. We have time. So it really is critical for everyone who's going to be involved.
Yeah. Let's take a minute. If you can bear with me, I want to tell my sleep training story because I think it's so important. So I've always been a single mom and I was in social work. There were many residential facilities. So once a week we'd have a staff meeting and there were two house psychiatrists. And I came in, he was about 7 months, and I came into work one day and both psychiatrists were like, what the hell? Like you need a mental institution. Like it's obvious. And I was like falling apart. And I said, Pascal is waking up every 20 minutes. And we were even co-sleeping. And he was waking up every 20 minutes to nurse. I was like super paranoid. I started to cry because I was so afraid in that underslept, super frustrated place that I would shake him, because that's what happens, right? Is nobody means to give their kid shaken baby syndrome. But I was like, I could see I was on the edge of that. And they were like, dude, you got to sleep train. And I was, if you were crunchy, I was like stale bread. Like I was so crunchy. And I was like, I'm not that bad. You know, and at the time you don't Ferberize your kid. And you know, that was the hot phrase. And I started to read Ferber and I was like, hey, not cry it out at all. Like there's a whole system. And so I fortunately had a nanny at the time. She said, let's do this. I'm going to take half the night and you take half the night. And we were, you know, we did the whole like back out of the room. It was like, there were all these things I hadn't thought of. Number one, at least for him at the time, he was like, no blackout curtains, no white noise. Like the child needs to hear the environment to feel safe. And the big thing for me was like, when soothing a child in a crib, put your hands through, not over, because that is the cue of I'm going to pick you up. And so, you know, we did it and he sleep trained beautifully in 3 days. And he has been the most excellent sleeper since then. Like as a toddler, he went to bed at 5:30. The sun was out. I was like, it's bedtime. He was like, okay, good night. Boom. And I really think it saved my life and his life. And I know that sleep training can probably be controversial in this, you know, world on internet experts everywhere. But man, the chance of me shaking him was so high. And I knew that, you know, and I think we have to take that part into consideration. So can we talk about moms for a minute? Just because we're the legions of underslept, I think, and no offense to you dads, but I just think moms catch the brunt of it that first year.
Absolutely. We're more hypervigilant. We hear more of it.
We hear more, but also I think we get so overtouched and overstimulated. We think that staying up later to watch a few Netflix, have a glass of wine, a bowl of ice cream, whatever our treat is, we think that's me time. And I have learned that going to bed at 7 o'clock with my child is the best me time I can get. It's like restorative sleep.
Right. And yet it feels unfair that somehow we have to choose, and maybe whether it's our partner or another parent has means to, you know, have their cake and eat it too. Yeah, that's like a, probably a whole nother conversation.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I feel like moms factor into the child sleep equation too, because like we have to show up as our best selves, because I think a lot of nighttime shenanigans happen because we're tapped out. And so we don't have any more curve left to our day. So we're like, fine, I don't care. Stay up or like whatever.
And we kind of tell ourselves that doing like, if I just do this in this moment will be over. And that is true. Unfortunately, you're then committing to doing that in an indefinite number of moments in the future. So I do tell parents, like, it does have to probably get a little harder to get a whole lot easier. And that can be a hard, scary step to take. But we have to start thinking about this as a health issue. There is tons of research, and it's not new, and it's out there. Everyone knows it, that sleep is critical, not just for our mental health, but also for our physical health. And then, of course, for our emotional health, our relationships, how we show up for each other and our kids. So we almost have to think of sleep as medicine. Like, you can't get it when you can get it. It has to be a priority, and we have to find ways to make it happen. And look, I don't love when babies or kids have to be upset or cry, but if they have to cope with a little healthy stress so that everyone can sleep better, I just like to give moms permission and combine that permission to prioritize their own sleep and walk their child through that process. Combine that with sleep training. I don't even prefer really to use that word just because it can be confusing for people. I say, let's think about it as sleep learning. Let's help this child learn a new way to get to sleep, to get back to sleep, or a new place to sleep. Maybe it's their crib instead of your bed. Just like with walking, you don't just plop them in the center of the room and say like, okay, figure it out. You kind of do a scaffolding process, right? You might hold my fingers as we go across the room, and then we'll do less. We'll hold just one, and then I'll kind of put my hands on either side of you. And eventually we let go. So I like parents to know, yes, it's important to address this. It's critical. And it does not have to be what you typically might think of with sleep training, which might be putting them down and walking away and not responding at all. It's a very young child. They're still maybe nursing or whatever overnight. It doesn't have to equate with eliminating night fees or ending your breastfeeding relationship if you're extended nursing. There are options. But if we talked more about the options, I think families would feel less trapped in staying in what works in the moment.
I want to go over like rough, you know, amounts of sleep that kids need, but also one thing even a quick Google, it's astounding that like missing 1 hour of sleep for a child will affect their cognitive, their growth, their brain development. Like, this isn't like a joke. It's serious. It's a nutrient. Like, if you don't get it, you're seriously setting your kid up for like big problems.
Yeah. The research really astounding. And I think what applies the most for why we're here today with the learning and the coping is the effect it has on self-regulation. So you just can't, you know, we're talking about little people, they don't have fully formed and won't for a long time prefrontal cortex. They're not thinking logically. They're thinking with their bodies. They're thinking emotionally. And if that body's not in a good place, really not thinking at all, they're just reacting. So yeah, the research is pretty astounding.
Yeah. And I always think too, like, so on Sunday night, I took a flight and it was delayed. I didn't get in until 2 a.m. We're recording on Thursday. I'm still not recovered. Like, I don't know how I stayed up in my 20s drinking all night. I don't even know how that happened. But yeah, and I also like, guys, think about it. When you're overtired, think of how sensitive you are. Somebody at the grocery store says something rude to you and you start to cry. So now imagine being two. Your skin's inside out because everything's brand new, right? You're already volatile with your emotions and have no control. And now you're underslept.
Yep.
So what are some rough times? Like, how much time do most kids sleep?
Totals are always probably the biggest thing that we're looking at. Although I would emphasize, you just mentioned the concept of like jet lag. Totals is not the only piece of sleep that we want to look at. We also want to think about appropriate timing of sleep. And what I mean by that is every kiddo has an internal clock. And maybe your best friend's kid can go to bed at 8:30 and get the right total, wake up refreshed, be regulated all day. But maybe your kiddo is just programmed for a 7:30 bedtime and they're not going to have their best night. The total might end up being the same, the quantity, but is the quality the same? That's what we have to ask ourselves. So as you're trying to catch up from your trip, you might catch up at off hours, hours that your body isn't used to and isn't programmed for. And you're not going to really feel refreshed from that. So parents sometimes get confused, like, oh, my total fits into the range of what should happen, but my kid's kind of still acting like a hot mess. There still could be some tweaking that needs to happen. So that was just kind of soapbox about that. But since most of the kiddos of the parents probably listening to this, I assume would be around 2 and 3, I personally, again, I'm taking a generic stab in the dark here, But I don't like to see kiddos that age get less than 10 and a half hours overnight. Now, if we pulled up the National Sleep Foundation recommendations, it would be a much wider range than what I'm saying. And that's, they're obviously basing that on something. I'm not going to say I'm more of an expert than they are. But I can say that when I see kids of those ages dip below about 10 and a half hours overnight, and for some below even more than that, we see a lot more bedtime struggles, a lot more night waking, a lot more early rising. So there is going to be, your child's going to have a minimum where if they consistently dip below that, things just aren't going to feel quite right. And then some of them are going to need as much as 11 and a half or even a little more. So I like to see something between 10 and a half, 11 and a half. Of course, some of those kiddos are still napping. So if they are, they may be fine on the lower end of the range. Same thing, a huge problem we run into with our three-year-olds is that they do still want the nap, or they are mandated to lay down and be quiet, and therefore they fall asleep at school. But because their sleep aids are changing, that's pushing their ability to fall asleep at night later and later, which is shrinking their night. And because their night is shrinking, then they want the monster nap the next day. So again, we have an issue of when we add that all up, it might look fine on a chart, but how that child is functioning throughout the day and the effect it's having on the smoothness of bedtime and the family might not look ideal. So that's it's a pretty big challenge. So total is important. It's just not the only key. So when they are napping, you know, something between probably 1.5 to 2.5 hours, but the more they get past three, the less I want to see the really chunky nap, if at all.
Yeah. My son napped actually until the week before kindergarten. And then I was like, oh shit, we got to practice staying awake. You got to go to school.
Right. And hey, look, you know, kids teach me things all the time. So if your kiddo is older and can nap and can still have a great night, it's absolutely fine. They don't fall into this category. But it is pretty common that one or the other will start to become compromised. And in our experience, if anything has to get compromised, we want to kind of chip away at the nap to preserve the night, because that's what's going to stay. And that's what's going to have them heading into the next day, you know, in their best place. And that does sometimes mean waking them from the nap.
Yeah, like an hour. So let me ask you this. What are the signs of quality? Because one of the things I find in my job, particularly with parenting, not so much potty training, but parents have lost their village. I think because of social media, we're accepting of a lot of things that are common, but not normal. So like, for example, we know that two-year-olds tantrum, but I'll get parents whose kids are literally tantruming 6 hours a day. And I'm like, no, that's not great. And I find that we're all so busy that a lot of things are like, oh, they're just a toddler. They're just a toddler. But like, what are some signs you would look for? Like somebody said, my kid sleeps 12 hours a day, but they have a hard time getting up in the morning. Like, what are some signs of low quality?
Yeah, for sure. So I agree with you. The tantruming thing or whatever word we want to use, I will say, like, how does your child seem? And they don't always have a measure of comparison if it's their only child. But do they wake naturally, or are you having to wake them to get to school? That is one thing. Ideally, if we've had enough sleep, we will just wake up on our own. If we're not waking on our own, we can kind of reverse that and say, well, maybe you weren't ready to wake, so maybe we need to tag a little bit onto the beginning. And again, we're not talking about like once in a while, but as a regular thing. So that's one good question. And then, you know, can they make it to the next sleep period, whether that's nap time or all the way to bedtime? I can't tell you how many parents are like, they fall asleep at the lunch table. They fall asleep on the playroom floor. That is atypical. So we would want to pay attention to that. I work with a lot of parents who say that they'll see people on the street and the people will say, wow, your baby looks very tired. They have dark circles under their eyes. That's a pretty obvious one. I mean, we all have different skin tones and features, but we know what tired people look like, right? But yeah, the regulation piece of the tantrums is confusing because the ages we're talking about, they're not awesome with self-regulation. But yeah, I agree with you. If it's, you know, situational and you can say, well, this is a big trigger for my kiddo. When we have to leave the playground, you know, they always fall apart. It's pretty consistent. But throughout the other areas of the day, I'm not really seeing that. If it's over everything all day long.
I call it pokey too. It may not even be like dysregulated. It's pokey. It's the kid who will trip their sibling. It's the kid who's like, at the cat and like, brush your teeth. I don't have teeth.
Well, and sometimes here's the most confusing. We're thinking of kids who act tired and look tired. But the most confusing thing for parents is that because the body's so amazing at overcompensating and surviving, kids kick into overdrive at a certain point of overtired. So they can look very alert and very energized as if they're not tired at all. but really they're just riding a second wind. So another thing I look for, I ask parents, you know, how do they seem in the evening? Are they normal, tired, hyper, wired? You know, some kids are racing up and down the halls and can't even seem to slow down, talking a mile a minute. If that's unusual and you're seeing it at the end of the day, that can be another clue that their quality is not so good. And then another one is just really frequent waking, which it's a chicken and egg scenario, but the more tired you become and the more of a sleep debt you accumulate, the more the quality of your sleep is compromised. So, and one way we can know that they're probably not well rested is they can't connect their sleep cycles overnight. And of course, getting back to a place where they can connect them can improve the qualities. And confusing waking up way too early in the morning, as counterintuitive as it seems, are early risers that are, you know, look, some kids are just early risers, but we're talking about, you know, 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m., 5 a.m. That's more than just early rising. And I define early rising really as anything before 6, but more importantly, anything before your child had an adequate number of hours of sleep. It's just too early to rise. That is usually a major red flag that they are overtired. And parents would think, well, then why wouldn't they just sleep more? And there's a long, complicated explanation for why that doesn't happen.
They're not like us. You can't judge it by that. But I will say this. So with my own son, so in utero, he started doing cartwheels at around 5:30 in the morning. So I knew I had an early riser and he was 5:30. When I tell you 5:30, I'm talking about a range of 5:28 to 5:32, like 5:30.
And that's that internal clock.
And listen, time change didn't matter. He was 5:30. Doesn't matter when the time changed. And so, of course, everybody told me, put him to bed a little later. I tried every time. And you know what? He needed to go to bed at 5:30. He went to bed at 5:30 in the evening and then he slept.
If the goal is to fix the early rising, there are ways to attempt to do that. But when we can, and there are cases like him, then the goal shifts in my mind to then let's just get him an adequate total by that time. But that can result in an awkwardly early, you know, bedtime for families.
No, it was awkward for everybody else. I got to leave the parties and I got to have a baby asleep at 5:30. I was a single mom, yo. I could actually watch a couple of things on Netflix and go to bed at 7:30. So I'm not like, I wasn't playing.
This is some pushback I get from parents a lot, and it's valid. A lot of us are working outside the home or even working within the home, but, you know, at a job that we need to show up for that's more than just parenting. And people say, well, how can I have to pick up from daycare. I have to get my kid home. I have to make dinner of their siblings. The struggle's real, right? We all know that. But I always say, like, really, we're just going to trade one thing that's difficult for another. If you can figure out logistically and give yourself some grace, ways to find time in the evening, get some help, order prepared foods, whatever you can do, cook a batch on Sunday, use a crock pot, I don't care. You know, yes, it will be a trade-off and maybe not one that you love, but if that solves everything else and it gets everyone the sleep they need and then potty training moves forward, you will in the end feel like it was a worthwhile trade-off. And it may not be for forever. It may be just to get through whatever you're trying to get through. Maybe then you can relax a little bit. It's not, nothing is like forever. We change and our schedules change.
You are so much more graceful than me. I'm like, stop being a big fat fucking baby. Listen, put your kid to bed when he needs to go to bed. But I do. I think that first year, we forget about that because I started to run into this years ago because dads, when I first started doing the potty training, it was largely stay-at-home moms with dads that worked outside the home. And the dads were coming home later and later because of like IT jobs, you know what I mean? And so they were like, well, no, my husband needs to see the baby. And I was like, no, you think you need that.
They'll be up bright and early and you can have your quality time in the morning.
Yeah, like we can't do that to suit our needs because we feel bad because we work. So now I need to spend quality time. And I was like, no, we can't suit our needs. Okay, so is this a sign? Because this is something I run into in my work a lot because I'm like, you're gracious with the 8:30. 2 or 3 year olds, I'm sorry, 6:30, 7 o'clock. Like really, if not in bed, heading to bed.
I agree. Actually, I should clarify that. My 2 year olds generally 7:30 is the latest I like to go. 3 year olds can sometimes handle 8:30, especially if they're napping and their wake time is reasonable.
Oh man, I was in fourth grade and my bedtime was 8:30. So. I'm old school. I'm going to get boomer on you now. No, but so what, like a lot of parents say, well, I did, I put them down. They'll already be too late in my mind. So it's like, oh, I put them down at 8 and they sit there and talk to themselves until 9:30. And I'm like, that's not, they have to go to bed earlier. It's like a weird paradox.
Yes. And a parent could easily look at that and say, well, therefore he isn't tired until 9:30. And, you know, look, to each their own. There are always going to be things that are outside the box that we're talking about. But by and large, what you're running into is a second wind, and it means that you missed it and you could have, and I don't say that as if like parents, you're doing it wrong. Just use that as information, as if you were a scientist, to see if that was a little too late and therefore it took too long, how can we get ahead of that tomorrow? I'm big on analogies, which you'll know by the end of this podcast. So the next one I'll throw at you is the train analogy, which I'm actually borrowing from my colleague Bernadette. If you are 5 or 10 minutes late for a train, as an adult, you're like, whatever, I did my best. Like, things happen, right? Well, the train doesn't care, Jamie. The train is gone. You're not on it. You have to try again the next time, right? And I don't want to make parents feel stressed that they have to be, you know, a slave to the schedule or whatever language they would use. I want to make them informed that we could be talking about a 5 or 10 or 15 minute shift, which in the grand scheme of adult life, seems like no big deal, but to a little person, it can be a very big deal in terms of the results. So yeah, that's a great point. I love to see, let's assume a child knows how to fall asleep independently, which maybe yours doesn't, and that might be a separate podcast. They can put themselves to sleep within about 10 to 20 minutes.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask too, yeah.
If they're asleep in moments, or as soon as their head hits the pillow, while that you might do a victory dance about that in the moment, it might come bite you in the rear later in the night because they were too tired. And if it takes much longer than 10 to 20 minutes, it could go either way. It could mean they weren't tired enough yet. In the vast majority of cases, it means we missed it. We got to get ahead of the train the next day.
Last year, I was getting ready for one of my big races, and I did this, it's a mental toughness program called 75 Hard, but you have to do 2 workouts and they don't have to be strenuous, but one has to be outside no matter what the weather. And I was wiped by the end of the day. Like, I was wiped. I didn't fall right asleep. I was a very good, healthy, tired, and I slept so well. And it just brought back, like, are the kids getting enough movement? Like, are they actually tired, or did they sit in a preschool chair all day and get like a recess? Does that play into it?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime we look, and for some kids more than others, anytime we look at basic sleep hygiene, it does include, or even just getting back to basics for our mental health, always fresh air and sunshine.
Yeah. And big play, like move your body.
And generally, if you're getting fresh air and sunshine, you are also moving your body. And look, the weather doesn't always cooperate, but you can get creative. We have Pinterest and TikTok now. You can throw all the couch pillows on the floor and make an obstacle course for your toddler and just let them climb all over everything. And we know that this is helpful also for bowel movement. If kids aren't getting enough movement,
big play, yeah,
maybe their bowels aren't moving properly. So we like to do big, big muscle movements when the poop is a struggle and we're trying to get it out.
But also on that note, you guys, don't be afraid of the elements. Like, unless I was working with a client, I was like, oh, you need to get outside more. She was like, it's negative 54. I was like, never mind. So, unless you're like in Minnesota in the winter, like,
that's a little extreme.
But, like, the elements will make them more tired, actually. And there's more to play with in puddles.
Well, and how many parents say, like, when we do, it's always swim class or the beach. Kids always, even my son, who was a total non-sleeper, I could always count on a monster car nap on the way home from swim class. And the time we took our family vacation at the beach, he literally slept the entire trip. I cried when we had to come home because I'm like, this is the only place he sleeps, with the sun and the surf.
Snow too, like playing in the snow. Yeah.
We also work with a lot of kiddos who we know have sensory sensitivities or differences, or I suspect that there's no diagnosis yet. And that can, of course, pose an issue with the ease of sleep, the soundness of sleep, and of course, the potty training process as well. So while all of us can do with movement, fresh air, sunshine, there are kids that if that is not part of their sensory diet, in quotes, throughout the day, they are not going to be able to put themselves to sleep and sustain that sleep. And it could be as simple as just being mindful and getting more activity in their day, or it could be as formal as getting an occupational therapy evaluation and some treatment to know what specific diet they would benefit from.
That's awesome. I wanted to go back for a second because you said even moving bedtime by 5 or 10 minutes. When I have night training cases for you guys, you know, you're doing your night training, that plays into it so much. And when I see like there's more than 2 P's a night, or they're really random, the parents are really trying hard, we look at the bedtime and I say, it's got to be earlier. And I do move them in 5 or 10 increments. And the same markers of like, they should fall asleep pretty quickly, like within 5 or 10 minutes, you know? And it's amazing because parents will move it up like just 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden they're like, boom, that was the golden hour.
And the other reason it's important to do it incrementally like that, if you make too big of a jump, you jump over that sweet spot. Now you're going to get a similar result of it taking too long, but for the opposite reasons. really are doing, again, like a little scientist. And of course, that's where working with someone can be helpful. If you're like, ain't nobody got time for that, you know, someone can look at that data for you and interpret it and walk you through it. But yeah, you want to be careful to really hone in and not jump over.
Right. And then I wanted to just kind of clarify too, you guys, the second wind. So, because I think what happens a lot of times is we're so busy that first tired goes past, because I think it's way earlier than parents think. I think kids start to show they're tired around 6. So then you would start all the stuff. Most parents aren't even looking for it. But check it out, you guys. Like, if you want confirmation of this, wait for your next party, like barbecue or Christmas Eve or one of these big events. And you can see it where the kids, they appear to be crashing. And you're like, oh, we should go. And then you're like, no, let's just have another glass of champagne. We're good. And then you see them level off. Then they look like angelic. And you're like, shit, yeah, we could stay till midnight. This kid's rocking it. And I've seen that cycle go like 3 times for a kid. Like, if you're at a long enough event, you're like, everybody's ramping up again.
Yeah. And, you know, if we went back to primitive days, we were being chased by a tiger extendedly. You know, we need to be able to, like, you've got to keep going. You've got to get through this. And that's what the body is primed to do. And it will do that, which, again, it's not tragic. Like, I don't want parents to feel like, oh, well, I missed it. And now they'll never fall asleep. They do eventually come down. It's like a hormone peak. And you always come down the other side from the peak. It's not going to be pleasant. The result's not going to be smooth, but there will be another opportunity to catch it. The other thing I'd love to add to that, we do so much education with parents that, yes, you can follow your child's cues, meaning are they rubbing their eyes? Are they starting to get cranky? Are they laying their head on your shoulder? However, just realize that for some kids, when they show that, it means it's go time and it's going to go great. For a lot of kids, it means it was go time half an hour to an hour ago, and I hid it from you because I'm busy and I'm excited and I don't want to miss out. And this happens especially if you would describe your child as easygoing, social, has a fear of missing out. They're going to try to power through, and then the body's going to, you know, kick in too. So can you follow their lead? Yes. But for one person, that might mean I see your cues, we go now. For another family, that might mean I use your cues to know that tomorrow night I start half an hour ahead of seeing them when I saw them, you know, the night before.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny because I just recorded a podcast for my parenting podcast. And I was talking about that I've been doing a lot more in-home, like not just potty training, but picky eating and parenting. And it's so great. I get to see everything in action. And I'd say across the board, everybody's missing cues. I was like, nope, you should have left the playground an hour earlier. Lunch should have happened an hour earlier. Nap should have happened an hour earlier. Bedtime. So yeah, that's really important. And I was a bad insomniac. Like, I almost went crazy from lack of sleep.
I mean, there's a reason it's used as a torture.
Yeah, I got bad in my 20s. And my mental health was shaky to begin with. So I didn't need lack of sleep. You know what I'm saying? And so, when Pascal, when he would do that, like the eyes and the head on the shoulder, Erica, I don't know if you ever saw a person move faster. I didn't even say bye to people at the party. I was out the door because I was like, I missed it.
Yeah, it's really, and when you educate parents about that, then they can see it through a different filter and they'll come back to me and say, like, now I noticed it. And, you know, crying, especially if we're talking about babies, but even with toddlers and preschoolers, crying is a super late cue. A lot of kids will do absolutely everything first. We really don't want to wait for a child to be crying. The stress hormones are already flowing at that stage.
Yeah. And then I just want to talk before we wrap up. You know, it's funny because somebody recently asked me, like, God, I used to live in San Francisco and Pascal was born in San Francisco. And they said, do you miss San Francisco? And I say, anything I miss about San Francisco was what I miss about being without a kid, right? Like, I was a single freelancing, like, just, I was having a blast. You know, when you have a baby, as joyous as it is, there is a mourning of the cool person you used to be, you know? And so we do, we lose a little bit of identity. That first year is so hard. And so some of what Eric and I are talking about, I think can feel suffocating, can feel regimented. And this is a season. And I will maintain till the day I die that this is the season to be regimented. You will be setting the foundation for the years. I have a 17-year-old right now who sleeps 17 hours a day. You will get sleep, I promise you.
Yeah, we have to drag them out of bed now, right?
Yeah, so don't worry, that time is coming. You know, my kid woke up every day, like I would offer him knives and fire. He would come up to me and lift my eyelids. Mommy, you awake? And so, like, just know that this is the season to be regimented. And I know it can feel like, oh my God, but these boundaries, I'm actually working with a family right now that they are able to do so much great work because they have this regimented very boundaried first 5 years, their lives run on clockwork. And yes, it is a little like, I have to be the first one to leave the party. I'm the one who leaves the playground first, but it's going to come back to you in spades. It's going to be awesome in a couple of years. So I just want to acknowledge that it can be really hard.
Absolutely. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, we're coming into Maternal Mental Health Month and I had undiagnosed postpartum depression and anxiety. I thought I had to put on a strong front. Nobody asked the right questions. I didn't let anybody in. There were a lot of failures of the system. And that's with me having a great support network and a lot of privilege. So not everybody has that. And so the stakes are even higher. We can't overestimate enough that mom's sleep is absolutely critical to the prevention or the treatment, the recovery from any kind of postpartum anything, which we're not just talking about the first few months. I mean, it can last for a really long time.
Postpartum depression can be up to 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, if you really want to do what's best for your kiddo, we're back to like replenishing the sponge that you're cleaning with, right? Or replenishing the bucket you're pouring from. I know it sounds super cliche and self-care, blah, blah. You have to get your own sleep.
Yeah, it's my new self-care. It is cliche, but it is the only way to fill your cup. Your massage isn't going to get you there. Your pedicure is not going to get it. Like even your girlfriends aren't. It's sleep, 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 sleep. Yeah. And then on that note too, you guys reach out, please. If you feel like you have postpartum depression, if you feel like we can be your village too. I have resources. Erica's got resources. Reach out because there is so many women suffer from it and you don't have to suffer. Now, I just want to caution this that I have a propensity. I go right to dead. I was never postpartum. I never had depression. But like when I tell you I can see something killing my child and I literally like plan the funeral really quick, but it's not intrusive. I let it go very quickly, but like that's just me.
Right. But it's scary and it's unwanted for sure. That's the other hard thing. It can look like rage. It can look like I don't feel bonded to my baby. It can look like possessiveness. I don't want anyone else around my baby. It doesn't always look like we expect it to look like, but it has the same, you know, the same roots. And just to emphasize to parents, especially moms, it is never too late to address sleep habits. It's not like there's this magical window. There's so much pressure like, oh, well, we didn't do it at 4 to 6 months. And now my child can speak and they can get up and they can leave the room and they're not in a crib anymore. And, you know, how do I make them do? They don't do anything I say and their favorite word is no. There are strategies for all ages. Even the toughest, most strong-willed, high-need kiddo can learn to sleep independently, can learn to sleep well. Even kids with high anxiety, we can work through that and take baby steps to get them sleeping by themselves. It is hard work. There's no magic, like you like to say. The magic is in the process for sure. But we do have some what end up feeling like magical strategies. So just don't be afraid. You know, we work with kids all the way through the school years.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, I had a note here. I just have one last question. Is there such a thing as night owls? Because parents will swear up and down that their kid is a night owl and needs to stay up till midnight.
I mean, I can only answer based on my experience, right? In my experience, it's almost always a case of what we were just discussing of something is off. Either they're napping when they shouldn't be napping or we're missing a window and they're getting a second wind. Anecdotally, there are definitely parents that claim that. And I'm sure that anything is possible because we're talking about humans and we're not robots. But generally speaking for kids, you know, there is a science to sleep and generally the science does not support them being night owls. If they can get the sleep they need, it works for the family. They're regulated. They're learning. They're hitting their milestones. You know, I'm not here to tell anyone that what they're doing is wrong if it's working for everybody.
And it has to be working for everybody. And I always say, I hope you plan on homeschooling because if your kids sleep until 11, even if they are a night owl, we got to train them not to be.
Absolutely. And I would bet it could be having an impact on each parent's time for themselves and then their time for each other, which in my opinion, then that isn't really
working for everybody.
Yeah.
Also, I tell parents this all the time. So they put in all this work for getting good sleep, right? They hire a sleep consultant, they get their kid going and they're like, you know, the kid gets sick or they go on vacation, the kid sleeps in their bed and they're like, but it was one time. And I was like, I don't know why, but sleep is like ruined by one time. Like one time you let the kid in your bed and you start from ground zero, it seems like.
Yes. And certain kids more than others, they just like, if you give them an inch, they'll take 3 miles. Yeah. We like to help parents get, first of all, to where they want to be or back to where they want to be. But then we do spend a lot of time saying, okay, awesome. Do your happy dance. And let's look ahead because it's unrealistic that they won't get sick and you won't travel and they won't get teeth. What's your plan going to be? What are the tools you're going to come back to if things start to go awry? And more importantly, what are the things you are never going to put back on the menu? If you had your kiddo in your bed and you don't want to do it anymore, that can't be on the menu when things go off. So we have like do not list, but we put a do list too, because we need things we can do, and set a deadline, set a darn deadline. If like, you know, it's a fever, okay, here's what we're going to do to get through this, if that's what you have to do. But it shouldn't still be going on 2 weeks after the fever, which is what your child will probably, it's unlikely most of our kids will come to us and say like, thanks, guys. That was cool, but I don't need it anymore.
Or sometimes when parents are co-sleeping, I find this too, parents who are co-sleeping for their own needs. Like dad got deployed and they're lonely. They're co-sleeping. Dad comes home and they're like, oh, and I literally had a parent say, no, I get to choose. And I was like, no, you don't. Not with a 3-year-old.
Yeah. Or it's working perfect for mom and, you know, child and dad. I'm like, but where's dad? Oh, he's in the basement on a couch. And
yeah,
he's
no.
Her for his back. I'm like, yeah, it really has to work for everybody involved. So yeah, the burden is kind of on us, as always, as the parent to get back, you know, to where we want to be. And usually just being a little mindful about how we approach those potential setbacks can help you navigate out of it pretty quickly.
That's good. Imagine that, planning. Imagine planning how you want it to go.
Imagine planning, right? I always say it's like more mindful than mindless. And I don't mean that as a, you know, an insult, but like if we have a game plan, you know, use a football analogy or whatever appeals to you, you don't just show up and be like, yeah, we'll figure it out when we get there. But that's what we do. We wait till our kid's sick at 3 a.m. We argue with each other for a while about what's going to happen because we don't agree. Then we're really, you know, busy with each other the next morning, or we regret our 3 a.m. decision. So it's better to say, here's what we won't do. Here are the things we can pick from.
I feel like that planning is across the board. That's how parents get backed into a corner. And that's part of, I think, what's happening with modern parenting is we're on this endless treadmill that is like, take care of everything for the moment, but there's no long-term, you know, it's how parents get backed into picky eating a lot of times. You know, if we're dealing with neurotypical kids, it's like, you just are looking at the next moment instead of like, where is this going? You know? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And there's, you know, so many reasons why that's happening, but I think just being aware of it is obviously the first step.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Erica. Thanks for your time. Tell people where they can find you if they need some sleep help or potty help or both.
Absolutely. So you can visit beaconfidentparent.com and learn all about our one-on-one sleep services and potty consulting services. All the support we offer is virtual, so we can help families anywhere. We have somebody from Germany and somebody from Spain this week, which is pretty exciting.
It's Be a Confident Parent?
BeAConfidentParent.com, yep. And we now offer support for kids that have disabilities and differences for sleep and some differences for potty training as well, like language delays, ADHD, neurodivergence. So I know that those families can sometimes feel like, well, maybe these strategies work well for typical kids, but my kid's not neurotypical or typical in another way. They're still kids. It's still a learning process. We just have to figure out how they learn, and we can still get them there.
Absolutely. Oh, right on. Thank you, Erica.
Thank you for having me. This was excellent.
All right. Thanks, guys. As always, I appreciate you. Rock on and have a great day.